St. Patrick, and Osiris. Now, on A View from the Bunker. As we approach March 17th, let me be the first to wish you a happy St. Osiris Day. Now, you're probably thinking that is St. Patrick's Day and that I am somehow confused, and here to explain why you may be wrong in that assumption is the publisher of the fascinating Secret Sun blog and a couple of satellite blogs that explore modern mythology, alternate history, and pop cult symbology. He's also the author of the Eagle Award-winning Our Gods Were Spandex, The Secret History of Comic Book Heroes, and the complete author, or rather the co-author of the complete X-Files, Behind the Series, the Myths, and the Movies. It's our honor to welcome Christopher Knowles to the bunker. Chris, thanks for being here.
It's a great pleasure. Long-time listener, first-time caller, you
know? I haven't heard that in a while. Well, 317, the day that we honor the green man of the Emerald Isle, St. Patrick, you suggest is actually based on an older celebration that takes us all the way back to ancient Egypt.
Yeah, well, we get it from the Romans, actually. 317, March 17th, was a festival called the Liberalia, which was their reinvention of the old Bacchanalia. And there's an interesting backstory behind that. Dionysus, who a lot of your listeners might be familiar with, was, you know, the god of wine and agriculture and things like this. Dionysus, the god of Nysa, one of these several interesting gods that come from Anatolia in modern-day Turkey. Very scandalous history behind the Bacchanalia. We had these celebrations in Greece where these housewives would go up into the mountains and really go crazy. I mean, there would be points where they would tear animals limb from limb and eat them raw. They were so wild and wound up. Music, and they actually had light shows. They used pyrotechnics and things like that. I mean, it was really a very wild thing. Probably the closest modern analogy to it would be Santeria or voodoo. Mm-hmm. A very smart sort of phenomenon. We had a lot of periodic crackdowns in Greece and in Rome. It was imported into Rome, I guess, in the mid-imperial era, but it was never, you know, really accepted. It was seen as sort of a foreign corruption of the true, you know, Olympian faith, as it were. So, you know, very similar, again, to maybe how modern Catholics would see Santeria. In 186 BC, there was a very famous episode in history where the Bacchanalia were suppressed by the Roman authorities after a series of scandals. I mean, a lot of the scandals may have been exaggerated in the histories. I mean, the Romans were great gossips. They loved juicy gossip, and they loved to sort of exaggerate a lot of their gossip. But in any event, there was a big crackdown of Bacchanalia, and what it eventually transpired is that thousands of women and some men were executed. And the criminal offense, the capital offense here that really concerned the Romans was revolution. That they saw these secret societies and these mystery cults sort of incubators for revolution against the state. And if you know anything about the nature of the Roman state, you can understand why they were constantly fending off rebellions and revolutions and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But this was a very famous case in history for its brutality. Men were essentially ordered, you know, ordinary men whose wives were involved in these Bacchus cults, Bacchus being the Roman name for Dionysus, were ordered to kill their wives or their daughters or their sisters, you know, sort of analogy almost to honor killings in the Islamic world today. So what happened then is that the Dionysus cults were very strictly controlled by the state. They were very tightly constricted. They were not allowed to have large assemblies. They were not allowed to have secret assemblies. And this went on for quite some time until the time of Caesar and Mark Antony. And they both were very involved, as you, you know, your listeners know, and history record, they were very involved with Cleopatra and Egypt and whatnot. And Dionysus himself was pretty much the equivalent of Osiris, Osiris being the god of the underworld, the god of grains, the god of running water, things like this. So, I mean, the similarities are, you know, very clear between these two figures. So what had happened is that both Caesar and Antony were very much concerned with pleasing the people. They were seen as what they were, demagogues. And demagogue means somebody who put the concerns of the ordinary people above the rich landowning families that controlled the Senate. it's funny when you go back and read a lot of these accounts how blunt they are about this. So what they wanted to do is that they were trying to buy favor with the commoners, because there were these constant power struggles. And they revived the Bacchanalia as the Liberalia. And it was essentially sort of a street parade, street fair. It evolved over time to, I guess, be more similar to Mardi Gras or mm-hmm. Carnival, you know, which is held around the similar time, you know, the early spring, late winter, depending on the calendar.
Right.
Yes. So, but basically the day of this festival was 316 or 317. Sometimes it, you know, ran for a few days. This was a very popular event and lasted for a very long time in the Roman festival calendar, which we all knew just grew and grew and grew.
Yeah. As it was co-opted by the growing church in Rome, which decided the best way to get them to join was to bring all their holidays in.
Well, that was a lot of that happened under Gregory the Great, Pope Gregory, who decided that if, you know, you can't beat them, join them. So mm-hmm. basically what happened is a lot of the pagan festivals, and you know, they had a pretty large empire, so they'd have a lot of festivals to deal with, and they all became saints days. I mean, I had friends when I was growing up who were in Catholic school and parochial school.
Right, me too.
And they were constantly having these days off for saints days. I was like, why do you have the day off? Oh, it's a saint's day. You know, and I'm sure somewhere back in history that it was an adaptation of some local pagan god festival.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, so this is how the date came to be marked. But also 317 in the Egyptian calendar, which starts in the summertime, not in the wintertime, was the date of the death of Osiris. And the record tells that this happened in the month of Scorpio, the astrological month of Scorpio, and I guess that would be November, but with precession of the equinoxes, it probably was sometime actually in October. So I think what happened here, and the syncretism and the synthetic nature of religion in the ancient world, that, like I said, both Caesar and Antony were very involved with Egypt, very involved with the Ptolemy dynasty. At one point, Caesar wanted to move the center of the Roman Empire to Alexandria. Alexandria was pretty much like New York back then. I mean, it was this huge metropolis, millions of people. It was a center of trade, you know, trade from Europe to, I guess, the Arabian Peninsula, you know, that whole entire area of Israel, the Levant.
Had the library, the renowned library there.
Well, they did have the library there, but the reason why all those things were there is because it was just an incredible center of trade from
right.
the Mediterranean to Asia. There were certainly a lot of people coming in and out. And I think that, it's very interesting because we know that, as I said before, the Romans were very distrustful of secret societies and rites, and Trajan, at the end of the first century, had banned them all. But I think that there was a lot of interesting sort of sub-Rosa connections being made here. And one of the reasons that I see this is that, for instance, when Caesar was killed, Cleopatra had a relief made of herself and his son, Caesarion, as Isis and Horus.
Oh, okay.
And it was carved into the face of the Temple of Dendera. And I always sort of saw that the death of Caesar always struck a chord that there may well have been a ritualistic aspect to this.
Mm-hmm. Harkening back to Nimrod and Semiramis and Tammuz.
Well, I would actually say harkening back to Osiris.
Well, sure, which some have argued, Peter Goodgame has made the connection that Nimrod was Osiris, but yes, similar stories. Okay. I see your point, yeah.
Yeah, so, and it's interesting, too, because it was the Ides of March, which would be the beginning of the Liberalia.
Yes, yes.
Of the Dionysus, and actually the two figures would have a single name, that there was a point the late Hellenistic era and afterwards where it was Osiris Dionysus. It was one figure. It was one god. And then, of course, but the thing that people need to understand is that what Osiris was in Alexandria was totally different than what Osiris was in Luxor or in another city, or and certainly as he was, a Serapis in Greece or in Rome. I mean, you didn't have the internet. You didn't have television. You didn't have mass communications. There was a lot of corruption. There was a lot of variation. And not corruption as far as crime, but, the basic original ideas being corrupted and evolving to suit the needs of the local populace and whatever. So, but I always think, and it's something that a better historian than myself could write a really interesting book about, that there was this ritualized aspect to the death of Caesar. And, of course, Antony took up with Cleopatra thereafter. And both of them, by the way, were highly scandalized for this. Rome had seen Egyptian religion, Egyptian culture. And I'm talking with the conservative Romans. It was very popular with the people, but the establishment saw all of this as being very decadent and feminized and all of this. So what had happened is that we had the Liberalia, and then I'm sure when Theodosius came in and did away with the Olympics and did away with the Vestal Virgins and all the mystery religions, all these things, that the Liberalia were probably sort of absorbed into some very sedate saint's day. And of course, St. Patrick himself is such a mythical figure in a lot of ways. I mean, we don't really know a lot about this character. He came from Wales at a time when there wasn't, a great infrastructure for history and writing and whatnot. So
no, but it was during the period right after the withdrawal of the legions by the German magister of I can't remember the Roman term, but essentially he was the military commander of Rome. And Honorius was such a weak emperor that Stilicho was his name. Stilicho withdrew the legions in about 410 or 404, I think, somewhere thereabouts.
Yes.
Which left the British Isles pretty much undefended against the raids by the Picts from the north and the Saxons from the east and the Irish from across the sea. So it was it was a pretty rough time to live in Britain.
It was a free for all.
Yeah,
it was a free for all, and we saw the the Druids were sort of still holding on there, and then we had the evolution of Celtic Christianity, which mm-hmm. was sort of a very Egyptianized version of Christianity, sort of a, I guess you would call a synthesis between Christianity and Druidism. But of course, there's a lot of good arguments that the Druids themselves were sort of a branch office of the Egyptian cults, and that there was, for instance, the Druids ran actual universities all across Northern Europe, and there was a university system basically started in Egypt and Alexandria and spread out from there.
Hmm.
So let's fast forward a few hundred thousand years or so to the revolutionary era, or the pre-revolutionary era. And this gets to be very interesting here as how St. Patrick's Day itself becomes a national holiday.
And you're talking the American Revolution now.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. In the pre-revolutionary era, St. Patrick's Day is not celebrated by Irish Catholics because there are very few of them in the colonies at this point in time. It's celebrated by Irish Protestants, and it becomes their nationalistic celebration, even though they're not Catholics. They reject the saints. You know, it's a very strange evolution how this all comes to be. And, of course, we have to sort of factor in Freemasonry here. Yes, because the Masonic system in America is not under the Grand Lodge of England. It's under the Grand Lodge of Ireland. That's the jurisdiction throughout the revolutionary period. So they begin to hold these marches and actually began in Morristown, New Jersey, of all places, because that was the headquarters of the Continental Army at the time. And then it spreads up into New York, and New York begins to have these festivals. And essentially this gets the blessing of George Washington himself. And over time we begin to see these waves of immigration from Catholic Ireland, especially, you know, Black 47, the famine period, the potato famine, that era. And this, you know, this naturally becomes a very big holiday. But the irony is here is that they had no idea about any of this. they had no idea that, you know, on St. Patrick's Day, you march and you drink and you eat beef and cabbage and things like that, because that's not what they did back in Ireland. Back in Ireland, it was just basically you might go. Sure, you might not. I mean, you know, Saints' Days had sort of almost fallen out of favor in some ways, you know, particularly during that time, and they didn't really have a lot to celebrate. But they would come to New York and find that there was this whole celebration of St. Patrick's Day,
which served the purposes of the colonists who wanted to revolt. If you stir up nationalistic impulses in these Irish who had no love for the English anyway, it would make for some very useful soldiers in the revolt.
Well, exactly. And the other thing, too, is that the Irish Protestants themselves were not generally part of high society in the colonies. I mean, they were seen as sort of ruffians from the borderlands. I mean, what we call Scots-Irish is actually sort of a combination of border English and lowland Scottish, who were sort of imported during Cromwell's time, you know, the time of the plantations and whatnot, into Northern Ireland, you know, as basically an occupying force. And this is something the British did all the time. You know,
right.
We see the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. They were brought in from – they're not native to Sri Lanka. They were brought in from India. So, you know, we see this all the time, that, that you import – a new population. You vote a new population in when your native-born population isn't sufficiently
servile.
Yes, exactly. Servile and submissive to your needs.
Yeah, the Assyrians were really good at that, we read in the Old Testament.
Yeah, so, I mean, this has a very long and storied history. And, of course, again, going back to Egypt, I mean, the creation of Serapis came about because there were these riots between native Egyptians and all these imported Greeks. And this took place mainly in the city of Alexandria, which was a big port city again. So Ptolemy decided, well, okay, you worship Zeus, meaning God, or Jupiter, God the Father, Deus Pitar. And we're going to make note of that because that is also the root word of Patrick, father. And you worship Osiris. So let's combine them both into this one figure that you both can agree on. You know, a very deliberate sort of syncretism that, you know, really had no basis in any of their history or their mythology. It was a political decision. And I think that the same argument can be made here with the evolution of St. Patrick's Day, that it was about instilling the sort of nationalistic pride in these marginalized Irish Protestants But also, again, we have this influence of Freemasonry. Now, the interesting thing is that Freemasonry, maybe in the 16th century, and certainly the 17th century, and then into the 18th century when it starts to become established. You know, it's very much based in the Kabbalah. It's very much based in sort of the biblical stories or corruptions of biblical stories, you know, with Biff and whatnot. So it starts that way. It starts off being sort of this strange combination of the Kabbalah and alchemy, certainly influences from the Rosicrucians and alchemy and things like that. But as the Age of Discoveries begins, where they start to unearth these amazing things in Egypt, in Greece, the unearthing of Troy later on, and I guess, what was that, the early 19th century? You'll have to forgive me here, but also, you know, not only Troy, but Pompeii, that they start to go, oh, yeah, well, the ancient Freemasonic tradition is no longer Kabbalah. It's now from Egypt, very conveniently, you know, because it has to do with fashion. And it's really no different today. I mean, you see a lot of this in sort of the New Age movements where, I mean, just in the past 20 years, you had the sort of Indian traditions, and then you had, well, traditions, quote unquote, because it's all very bastardized and whatnot, but to Native American, to Celtic, I mean, it's almost like they're going through the list. I think that that's not a new phenomenon. I think that that certainly was going on in Freemasonry, that all of a sudden they decided that they were Egyptian and, you know, that their roots were from ancient Egypt and whatnot. And I think that that sort of plays a part in some of these incorporations, this little wink, wink, nod, nod to Osiris Dionysus in St. Patrick's Day. You know, and it could have been anybody. I, you know, whoever saint, I think every single saint has a day in the calendar. You know, whoever fell on that magic day of 317, that was not only the day of the death of Osiris in the Egyptian calendar, but also the day of the Dionysus celebrations in ancient Rome.
But there are a number of other connections that you point out in your articles at The Secret Sun that tie the symbology or the things that we associate characteristics of St. Patrick with the characteristics of Osiris. For example, Osiris always depicted as the guy with green skin, because he's the god of the dead. Yes, he took wearing of the green to the ultimate. I mean, he was green. But Ireland, the Emerald Isle, Patrick, all connected with this green everywhere, green beer, green eggs, stuff that Patrick himself probably would have thought was just absolutely, he would have been appalled, I think. But all of this symbology has been associated with Patrick. Did this all just happen by accident?
Well, that's not for me to decide, but the interesting thing about that, again, you know, the wearing of the green, I mean, and this is interesting because this is something I sort of intuit. I mean, I grew up in Boston where St. Patrick's Day is obviously a very big celebration.
Sure.
But it struck me that it falls right near the spring equinox. Just a few days away. And it seemed to me, even before I had the historical context to put it in, that very much reminded me of a pagan fertility parade. You know, it reminded me of the things that I would read about from pre-Christian Britain. You know, it almost reminded me of the Wicker Man. But, you know, the interesting thing about this as well is that beer, you know, what are the sacraments of St. Patrick's Day? It's beer, beef, and cabbage.
Right.
Now, this all goes straight back to ancient Egypt because Osiris was seen as the patron god of the cereal grains that they grew actually from his body. And Isis came and gathered them up. She gathered up the grains that were growing from his corpse from the underworld. That's how they made beer, right?
Now, okay, ew.
Yeah, well, you see actual depictions of this. I think I might have one of these in the original article itself. But beef is obviously the Apis bull, which was sacrificed to Osiris. And then that's part of Serapis, the Apis cognate of that name, the bull that was sacred to Osiris. And it's interesting as well that the bull is also sacred to Dionysus, that he would often take the form of a bull. And the funny thing here is cabbage. I mean, cabbage was actually used by the ancient Egyptians because they believed that it would help delay over-intoxication. That if they ate enough cabbage with a beef and beer, they wouldn't get so drunk so fast and pass out. I mean, they were party animals. The ancient Egyptians were like, they had, you know, basically, you know, had their version of spring break. I mean, they had the festival of, actually, it was called the Festival of Drunkenness. They would all come together and celebrate the salvation of mankind from Sekhmet, who was going to destroy the world, and then the gods fooled her by dyeing all the beer red. So she thought it was blood, she drank it, and she passed out, and she woke up as Hathor. So again, I mean, it's these traditions sort of get encoded somehow into our DNA, and we're completely unconscious of them. St. Patrick's Day seems to me that, you know, I always hate to say this, but it almost like it was an experiment in some ways of taking this sort of ancient holiday and giving it this gloss. And don't forget, I mean, this is a point in time that not only are there very few Catholics in the colonies, but there's a high degree of anti-Catholic sentiment because you have a lot of Puritans, you have a lot of
right.
Yeah. Lutherans, Anglicans. I mean, a whole host of people who are very much hostile to the idea of the saints, to St. Patrick. So why is this holiday sort of showing up that isn't even being celebrated by Catholics? It's very strange. But I think that it was sort of an experiment, and this is, again, this is nothing new, but of sort of taking an ancient tradition and introducing these ideas by giving it sort of a very bare gloss, very of, I guess, respectability. And now, of course, I mean, it's one of the major blowouts of the young drinking calendar, right?
Yeah, you know, along with big excuse for a party, along with the Super Bowl Sunday and Halloween and 4th of July weekend, you know, just an opportunity. But you're right. There aren't many other activities associated in the United States today with St. Patrick's Day other than the corned beef and cabbage and drinking a lot of green beer. I grew up in Chicago where they dye the river green. So you know, I'm right there with you when it comes to, you know, knowing a little bit about how this holiday is celebrated here in the States. But what really intrigues me about this holiday and this date is the symbolism that you've picked up on this this date 317. We nominally celebrate in honor of St. Patrick, which you tie back through certain symbolism and through the Romans all the way back to Osiris. But it keeps showing up in all kinds of other cultural references. Can you lay some of those out for us?
Oh, they're too numerous to mention. I mean, just off the top of my head, I mean, I remember you and Sharon talking about this, the at Chicago, the sighting of the UFO at O'Hare, which is at gate C-17.
Right, right.
Third letter of the alphabet. Uh-huh. And I believe there's also a C-17 fighter plane or cargo plane or something like that.
C-17 cargo plane, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, 17, it's interesting because – oh, and also the now-canceled Constellation patch, which was going to include the Orion – it's funny, I was just tempted to say Osiris – the Orion moon – mission, had a very cleverly concealed 317 in it. And, you know, of course, that's NASA. I mean, nothing surprises me with NASA. Now we hear that there's a new program called OSIRIS-REx. It's like they decided to just sort of dispense with the sort of the politically correct Grecian gloss to all this. Just go straight to the source.
Maybe they needed to make it really clear so President Obama got the message. I mean, you know, he canceled the Constellation project, and, you know, maybe they need to make it a little more clear.
Well, I'll tell you something. There's a news story about this today that he's going to be announcing his new plans for the space program. And one thing I talk a lot about on the blog is that the space is going to be a very big thing in this country. It almost seems to me that we're being sort of groomed to become Starfleet, you know, the world Starfleet. We have Microsoft, we have Google, And we have the founder of PayPal, Elon Musk, who has a company called SpaceX. We have a lot of people pouring a lot of money into private space programs. We also have Richard Branson, who has the spaceport in New Mexico. This is going to be a very big thing. And sometimes I wonder when we see sort of the dismantling of the economy around our ears, some of your readers, listeners, I should say, may have been noticing that.
Yes.
You know, for the past 20 years or so, that all of our jobs have been exported to India and China. And
yeah, and those jobs are now being exported to Bangladesh. So. It's a-
But I, it seems to me that there's a very quiet but extensive effort to reinvent the United States, again, as Starfleet. And that's why I've been watching a lot of Star Trek, because I've been looking to sort of see if they're sneaking any clues about our future into that. And it's interesting that they had that big relaunch just last year with Star Trek. But back to what I was saying before, Obama has made an announcement that he is going to be laying out his plans for the new space program, the new NASA, on April 15th, which is not only tax day, but it's also the first day of the month of Panyi in the Egyptian calendar, which was sacred to Horus, who was Apollo. You know, Apollo and Horus were the same figure, in just as Osiris and Dionysus were the same figure in the ancient world, Horus and Apollo were also the same figure. And actually, Apollo was not really identified with the sun until much later. And that's why I'm saying we have these sort of ancient religions, but I think at some point in time that there's something else that starts to pop up, and it's in this sort of sub rosa, secret society, mystery cult, mystery religion, mystery schools, that we start to see the emergence of something else that runs parallel to our known religions, the official, the state religions. Mm-hmm. And of course, the great example of this is the Knights Templar, who were much more hardcore. And I was doing an interview with some people who had actually studied medieval history. You know, this guy's degree was in medieval history. And I said, you know, the Templar were sort of like the Hell's Angels of the Crusades. Mm-hmm. And he agreed with that. He said that those were the guys who drank the Kool-Aid. That there was, there is a parallel here. And I think it sort of expresses itself in symbols. And I think St. Patrick's Day is probably a good example of this, that it means something to the ordinary Joe who gets to go out, maybe gets a day off from work, gets to go out and drink and eat corned beef, you know, eat what we call boiled dinner back in Boston, which is one of my favorite dinners, by the way. I love that stuff. Anyway, yeah. You know, potatoes and whatnot and all this stuff, and, you know, just have a good time and then feel like crap the next day. But there's also an understanding that, there's something else being observed here.
It's a very Gnostic, again, the secret knowledge that only the adepts are privy to.
But this, again, this ties right back to Rome, because all the mystery cults had, they had the cults for the initiates, but they also had the churches. They had, I mean, literally, they were churches. And then they, the rites and the liturgy and the sacraments of the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, are very much very heavily influenced. I mean, you had holy water, because what was holy water? Holy water was the water from the Nile in the Isis cults.
Hmm.
And they would have vespers, they would have bells, they would have incense, they would have all, I mean, you name it. They had the whole, it was all there. I mean, so little has changed. So we had Caesar's death 2 days before March 17th, the Liberalia, 317, Osiris, all these things. His death initiate, it not only initiates this festival, but it also initiates ultimately the empire. We have a struggle between all the various factions, all the various families that are controlling the Senate, and then it emerges with Augustus, Augustus being the Caesar, the emperor. And this was a society that was allergic to kings, was supposed to be allergic to kings, and now we have the empire. And this changes the scope of European history. So you really start to wonder if this assassination was a ritual and not just a political move. And that's something that I've felt for a very long time. And the overtones with his relationship to Cleopatra sort of give it that that veneer in some ways.
So what are the connections to the symbology, the symbolism in our pop culture today? Because there have been a number of posts that you've put up over recent months that detail that point out all of these various places where this number 17 and 317 especially are showing up in just an odd place. In fact, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes today, as 37 is sort of a cryptogram or a hidden 317, and we've got the Oscars tonight, and we'll talk about why that's symbolically important. What does it mean for the United States? I mean, or the world today?
Why
are we seeing it?
Well, that's a question. I mean, I can give you sort of my instinctual answer. I mean, I can't necessarily answer as a journalist. The best example of Obama seemed to be really interested in this number, all these 17-minute speeches he gave and all sorts of connections with that. Obama's very interesting as well, because I've written on the blog about the seeming obsession that he has with the astronaut, the martyred, our modern-day Osiris Gusterson, who was killed in the Apollo 1 fire. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that he chose the day, the anniversary of that fire, of the Apollo 1, to basically put the hammer down on NASA, like we spoke before.
Mm-hmm.
With all these things, I always try to be clear that there's a number of things going on. I do believe that there are people who are sort of playing with this, that are using this in a ritualistic fashion. But it's a cosmic trigger, and it gets very difficult to differentiate the two, because once these memes start bouncing around in your subconscious, it's kind of like, you know, a song that you hear on the radio. The other day I had Van Halen's "Why Can't This Be Love," a song that I really hate, going around in my head, and I couldn't get it out. You know, and I think that's the same process is going on with a lot of these memes and these symbols. But don't forget that we're constantly being bombarded with symbolism. We're constantly being bombarded with memes and numbers and all these sort of things all day long. A lot of them we filter out. And maybe on a subconscious level, we tune into certain ones, tune into certain memes that are being repeated in ways that we might not necessarily be able to consciously explain, but they resonate, they register in our subconscious mind. 17 has a lot of very important meanings. Let's go over some of those. In Chaldean numerology, it's the number of immortality. So that's a very powerful connection if you're interested in numerology and the occult and whatnot. One of my favorite ones here is also the tarot deck. The 17th card is the star card, which also has the water bearer. It's the age of Aquarius.
Mm-hmm.
So it could very well be that 17 not only signifies, you know, the death of Osiris, immortality, and also the new age, you know, this new age that's being brought about now, that we're in the transitional phase of. So it could have a number of different meanings. There's actually, I will post, when I link this talk, I will post, there's a great paper that some guy at some college did of all the significance of 17. And when you know, getting back to what we were talking about with Star Trek, I've been watching Star Trek The Next Generation with my wife. In every single episode, there's a 17.
Huh.
So, you know, the awareness of this seems to go back, you know, a little farther than the past.
Well, sure. And you know, we've had a fascinating discussion, a couple of discussions with Peter Lavenda early in the PID radio career, I guess, when we talked about the connections between Gene Roddenberry and that odd group that channeled these entities that called themselves the Nine, which eventually turned out to be, or they called themselves, these entities, the Aeneid, the nine principal gods of Egypt. And Roddenberry worked that into Deep Space Nine, certainly, but seemed to work that into a lot of what he did throughout the entire Star Trek franchise.
Well, he wasn't really involved in Deep Space Nine, so he was very sick at the time.
Right.
But he sort of signed off on it. But there are a lot of interesting, you know, when you talk about channeling and entities and whatnot, that's what that entire series is about. But certainly The Next Generation, there were nine principal characters. This is something I talked about on the blog, that they all sort of correspond to, not necessarily Aeneid, because it's almost a primitive form of Egyptian religion, but more what, you know, along the lines of the pantheon, you know, more the figures that we're more familiar with. Because, again, don't forget that these religions were not static. They were very volatile.
Mm-hmm.
And with the occupations of Greece and Rome, you know, for a good chunk of that era, that there was a tremendous amount of influence, you know, there's things being exchanged and ideas being changed and, you know, but there was also this tremendous sort of mystique. I mean, what India was from, say, the time of the Theosophists to the 1960s, that's what Egypt was for hundreds of years. It was this mysterious land of wonder and enchantment and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the ancient world. And it seems to, you know, now the modern world.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
There's like there's some major Egyptian oriented story in the news every day now. It's amazing.
Yep. As regards Star Trek, there'll be a time in the near future where I'd like to have you back to talk about the symbology and the memes that are just packed into a lot of what passes for sci-fi these days. Star Trek Caprica in particular, I know you've been writing about quite a bit, but in the interest of keeping this interview down to a manageable length, one of the cultural events that you write about, and again, the symbology in the culture in which we soak is a major theme of your work. I've got to say that, Chris, you see things in places that most of us don't even know to look. Tonight, of course, the Oscars. And
yes.
I'll need to, you know, let you go before that show starts so you can live blog.
I can't watch it. The Disney and Cablevision are having a battle. So
Channel
7.
No place to stream it live online or anything?
I don't think so.
Well, anyway, you've written extensively about the symbolism in a lot of these pop culture events, music awards shows, the Olympics, and tonight the Oscar. What do you see, just as one example, as the symbology in the Oscars that we should be looking for, those of us who are living in an area where ABC's not feuding with our cable company?
Well, certainly the Babylon Gate, the Kodak. For years, the Oscars were held at the Shrine Auditorium, and the Shrine being Scottish Rite Shrine.
Sure.
And then they moved to the Hollywood and Highland Complex and the Kodak Theater. Now, in the courtyard of this complex is a reproduction of the Babylon Gate from, I guess, a Cecil B. DeMille film. You know, why is it there? It doesn't make any sense. It seems to be the most incongruous thing. I mean, what does it say about Hollywood that there's the Babylon Gate? And of course, I would, as I point out a lot, you know, with a lot of the symbolism we see in sci-fi, it's the Stargate. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, how many episodes of Stargate have we seen? All the different series, Stargate SG-1, Stargate Atlantis, another Stargate universe. Babylon means Gate of the Gods.
Right.
It's a very interesting symbolism to put in the backyard of the biggest night in entertainment, basically. I mean, this is the biggest award show. This is probably the first of the big award shows. It probably predates the Grammys and whatnot. This is the big event, right? And, of course, I'm not going to be able to watch it. And it's funny when we talk about 3/17 because today's 3/7/10, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting day for this to be going on. That's the first thing I would look for. And one thing I noticed is that when a lot of times when they're doing the red carpet interviews, when they have the nominees for the actresses, they will sort of frame them in the Babylon Gate. You know, you'll see the Babylon Gate sort of surrounding these actresses. You'll see it in the background. And, of course, interestingly enough, behind the Babylon Gate, the Renaissance Hotel, you know, of course, interesting symbolism there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing that you should look at. But if you're familiar with, I guess, Masonic symbolism, and actually, since they moved from the shrine, you don't see as much of that now. It's a different set of symbols. It almost seems like they're ratcheting back the time machine that they started off with. This, you saw, particularly the last Oscars that they held at the Shrine Auditorium. It was basically stage sets where all these different, you know, depictions of the tracing board, the Masonic tracing board. Yeah, you'll see that on the blog as well. It's very fun. But you know, the thing is that it's not something I necessarily. I mean, is this the producers who are involved in this? Is this the stage designers? I mean, where is this coming from? Who is fascinated by this? What is the interest here? And I think there's a lot of maybe what I would call lazy thinking, people jumping to conclusions that sort of obscure maybe more interesting connections and maybe more connections that are more palpable that we can sort of follow. And I guess
by lazy thinking, do you mean just somebody, say, for example, we see the Babylon Gate there and immediately point and yell, "Evil!" and not take
well,
it a step
not necessarily,
further?
Well, when I say, it's like, oh, the Illuminati, you know? I mean, it's like...
Okay. All right.
The whole master plan, monolithic conspiracy idea that I know that you and the Collins brothers have punctured holes in sometimes when they've been on the show. You know, there are a number of different power bases that are all constantly vying for attention, and that's, to me, makes it even more interesting because it's almost like these battles they have, you know.
Mm-hmm.
With a flashing gang signs at each other, because gang signs are these ancient, weird, occult, Masonic, or whatever symbols.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
But
well, you know, and that's not outside the realm of possibility. We read that in the Bible that you know, according to the research of Dr. Michael Heiser and the Divine Council Group, that God put these 70 fallen angels over the earth, and it's not beyond the realm of possibility that these guys are vying for power themselves, these supernatural forces. So you know, it doesn't strike me as too far fetched.
Well, it's too bad it's not the 17 fallen angels.
Yeah, yeah. But again, the 70 relates back to Osiris because Set killed Osiris with 70 conspirators, or 72, which essentially in ancient, for theological purposes, was essentially the same number.
Oh, was it?
I'll defer to the research of guys like Peter Goodgame on that, but yes, as I understand it, the number 70-72 is essentially an interchangeable number because it's, what is it? It's it's some numerical division of 360 degrees or 25, something like that. And of course, here I'm opening my mouth without the research to back me up. But
well, you can edit that out. But and one thing that you and I have discussed on email, getting away from sort of the pop culture and maybe closer to home for some of your listeners, is look for this symbolism maybe in places that you might not necessarily expect it.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the pole movement.
Right.
Now, for most kids who are involved in this, they're probably very sincere and very dedicated and honest. But the fact that they're congregating in a circle around a pole, you know, an obelisk, if you like.
Right.
At sunrise on or near the autumn equinox.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's straight out of ancient sun worship.
Well, and my daughter participated in that a couple of years in middle school, and I went with her to it, not thinking anything more about it.
Yeah, and to me, that seems to be the same, almost the same kind of phenomenon as St. Patrick's Day. Now, let me just enter this caveat. It could be completely coincidental. I mean, it's not necessarily, I don't know who these people are who devised this whole display. But the fact that they're hitting so many of these ritual steps is very strange to me.
Yeah. Whoever came up with "see you at the pole" had to think things through a little bit more deeply than your typical fifth grader.
Yeah, it's very similar. Again, when I wrote about this on the blog, I put a video of a bunch of neo-Druids and neo-Pagans basically doing the same exact thing as Stonehenge, you know, singing the songs and playing the guitars, you know, at sunrise in the stone circle and all the rest of it. So, you know, if you understand the symbolism, you'll start to see it in places that maybe necessarily doesn't belong. And I think that maybe that would be the very least a good cue to maybe look further into the groups that are involved in this and what necessarily is their
motivation.
You know, because I always, you know, it's interesting because one thing that I always sort of scoffed at in a lot of conspiracy literature was the whole idea of the New Age Messiah and whatnot, because I always saw that the Bible was very clear that the church would be corrupted from within. That the Antichrist would be accepted as the Christ. You know, you see what I'm saying? To me, like a sort of a New Age or a cult figure would be too marginalized. So, I mean, this is something that perhaps, you know, maybe the nominal, the words being used and the symbols being used may not be the same thing. And that's maybe why, you know, studying things like St. Patrick's Day are important. Personally, I see St. Patrick's Day as pretty innocuous. Another day I wanted to mention, too, was Cinco de Mayo, which suddenly became a big holiday in the 80s.
Right.
And that, of course, is Beltane. It's one of the days, you know, commonly recognized as Beltane, the cross-quarter day of the Celtic Druid calendar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the witches, some call it the witch's calendar. You know, all of a sudden Cinco de Mayo becomes a big deal, which is, you know, where did that come from?
Well, yeah, I mean, nominally it's the celebration of the Mexican army's one historical victory, and of course it was over the French, which I'm sorry,
that's why, you know, Americans in North Dakota celebrate it.
Exactly, yeah, but how did it get from being a national holiday in Mexico to being something that you know, causes you know, my historic ancestors in North Dakota to have a cold one? Hey,
but the other thing I wanted to mention, we talked about this before the show, was this production they're putting on day in Washington, again at sunrise and at the Lincoln Memorial, which of course is a reproduction of the ancient Temple of Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
The statue of Lincoln is based on the seventh wonder of the world, the statue of Zeus at the at Olympia. And that, to me, again, could be completely innocuous, completely coincidental. You know, this whole idea of the sunrise is certainly kind of peculiar. And, of course, May Day was the original date of Beltane, also Walpurgis, you know, again, part of this ancient pagan calendar. It seems like a very strange way to celebrate or protest godlessness or whatever in government. And I would say that, you know, if you were going to sort of reintroduce these concepts into society, the best way to do it would be through a political venue where you draw lines through these sort of arbitrary political divisions, and that necessitates a short-circuiting of people's critical facilities, you know, particularly religious people. They, you know, that they, their emotions will be manipulated through politics, and they're not necessarily paying attention to what they might be signing on to. And I think that's something that people should be keeping their eyes out for.
Yeah, in other words,
more serious note.
Yeah, in other words, as an example, the Dominionist movement.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The funny thing about that, it's not funny, it's scary, but I've always said the Dominionist movement always seems to be based on Satan's temptation of Christ in the desert. You know, you have bread, you know, money, materialism, dominion, kingship, and also the idea of putting God to the test, that, you know, if the dominionists create the proper conditions, that will force Christ's return. That's putting God to the test. So it seems to be a pretty interesting mandate for a quote-unquote religious movement or quote-unquote Christian movement to be basically following the temptations, Satan's temptations in the desert. Again, could be coincidental. Could be unconscious. I don't know.
Yeah, but well worth asking the questions and looking a little deeper than just accepting that anyone who says he's playing on the same team is telling the truth.
Well, again, I mean, you had basically a situation in the early Middle Ages where it was very difficult to convince people in the far-flung districts, in the rural areas, to give up their ancient gods and whatnot. So basically what they basically did is that the gods became saints and their holidays became saints' days or festival days or whatever. You know, the Christmas tree and Easter eggs and all these sort of things that we associate with religion, modern religion, are really very ancient, the Yule log and things like that. Again, I mean, I don't think personally that it does a Christian any harm to have an Easter egg hunt or have a Christmas tree or things like that. I think that you can put that in the context of your faith without, do you understand what I'm saying? These things to me seem more innocuous than maybe some more hysterical types might see them.
I think Paul made it very clear that those who celebrate those days do it for the Lord, and those who decide not to celebrate those days do it for the Lord. They do it because they believe that that's what God would want them to do. I mean, you know, some guys eat meat for sacrifice to idols because, hey, it's meat and that's it. Others say, no, this I'm not going to touch it. But as long as you're doing it for the right reason and not because you're making it a another on a list of rules that everyone else has to follow, then it, you know, then you're doing it for the right reasons.
But I think it's very important, you know, on a more serious note, to be aware, because people will say things with words that they won't say with symbols. I always say that people are much more willing to lie with words, obviously, than they are with symbols, particularly people who take symbols very seriously. They're not necessarily going to try and present a dishonest message with symbols, whereas they could very easily lie with their tongues. Seems to me, and it's across the board, people of all persuasions tend to take symbols more seriously than they do words. I mean, we throw words out by the thousands all day. You know what I'm saying?
What's the meaning? What does "is" mean?
Yeah, well, the meaning of is ISIS, obviously, right?
Yes, yes.
So, again, I mean, I think how is this useful? You know, this is my old school Protestant upbringing coming through here. You know, how is this discussion useful? I think this discussion is useful that if you study the history and if you study the symbols and if you study the history of the symbols, then when they begin to be presented to you, whatever your belief system is, I mean, I know you have a lot of non-Christians who listen to the show as well, you will understand what is being said to you. And I think that's very important because the words will always – when a politician's lips are moving, they're lying. But maybe necessarily when they're speaking in symbols, they're be very – you know, particularly if they're part of Masonic – you know, and by Masonic, I don't mean Freemasonic. To me, the Freemasons are very low in the whole echelon. You know, you see the groups, the collegiate group, the fraternities, and all these other groups as being much higher in importance. And that's something I just want to make clear, because I think people sort of tend to scapegoat and demonize the Freemasons when they should be paying more attention to groups like Phi Beta Kappa and Knights of Theus. You know what I'm saying? Certainly Skull and Bones, certainly Skrull and Key, certainly Wolfstead. That there's this whole infrastructure of groups that are much higher in that continuum than the Freemasons. I think the Freemasons tend to get maybe
they're the stalking
or blamed than they deserve.
They're the stalking horse. The guys in the Blue Lodge don't know what's going on. I mean, some of the higher level speculative Masons who freely post a lot of their stuff on the internet or post disinfo on the internet, who knows? But they make pretty clear that their aims, their goals are certainly more esoteric than the guys at the local lodge who are just there to hang out with their friends and do some good works for the local, you know, children's hospital.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think for a lot of these guys, it's basically a social, and they tend to get very defensive. So I don't want to, you know, draw false inferences here.
Right.
But let me just make one more statement here about why this is useful. I believe that there are a lot of genuine secret societies. Now, what I mean by that is societies, groups of politicians, businessmen, what have you, who we don't know about. We don't know their charters. We don't know their signs of recognition. We don't know their texts. We may be able to sort of see their footprints through symbol. You with me?
I'm absolutely with you. They would say one thing, no, we're not doing that. We never did. Yeah, we don't even exist. I don't know what you're talking about. When you see the symbols, well, you know them by the fruits of their actions. And one of these fruits, I guess, would be the symbols that they use to identify themselves.
Yes. And, you know, as things get, you know, increasingly dicey and uncertain, in, you know, particularly in America, I think it's very important to keep your eyes out, you know, if for nothing else than the protection of yourself and your family. Because I really do. I think that, you know, if we know about them, you know, they scare me a lot less than perhaps these groups out there that we don't know about, which I do believe exist. And I think we can sort of see traces of them, you know, walking like ghosts throughout the meme stream. And it's something that I'm tracking for quite some time. And, you know, I'm afraid I'm no closer to understanding it than I was when I began the blog, but I absolutely do think that there are groups out there that are very powerful who we just simply don't know about.
Yeah, it's the guys we know about that
you can get a handle on it.
Yeah, and that's a conversation I've had with some other fellows. So when you talk about guys like the Bilderberg Group, who are, again, draw a lot of attention. You know, Alex Jones has shown up at their last couple of meetings with his bullhorn. But if you wanted to do things behind the scenes without any accountability whatsoever, would you call an annual meeting of 300 of the most powerful people in the world, people who can't go for a hot dog without drawing media attention, all to one place?
No, you do it over a secure phone line.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm right there with you. And you know, we'll have to continue this discussion and talk about this further. And we definitely will keep an eye on the Secret Sun and your sister sites, the Solar Satellite and the Solar Seminar, for your thoughts and examinations. Because like I said, you know, Chris, Sharon and I both have found that you see things that the rest of us, in places the rest of us don't even think to look. Like, for example, the Oscars. We may just tune in tonight just and without having planned to beforehand, just to see what we see. And I do want to have you back, you know, at your convenience to talk about what you call, and I think brilliantly, spy-fi or spiritual fiction. You know, things like the new Caprica series, which is examining what it means to be human. And, of course, one of the major themes of Battlestar Galactica was the theology, the polytheistic humans and the monotheistic Cylons. And there are any number of other, and of course Deep Space Nine, which had a very strong theological component too. And I need to go back and watch, you know, things like that. I think are worth discussing because they do say something about the way these issues are being put into the public consciousness, and perhaps in ways that aren't quite obvious on first viewing.
Yeah, and certainly with technology, I mean, it just amplifies everything now.
Right.
You know, the potentials are just so much greater than they ever were before.
Absolutely. The blog is The Secret Sun. The books are Gods Wear Spandex, The Secret History of Comic Book Heroes, and The Complete X-Files Behind the Series, the Myths, and the Movies, and the author and co-author of them all, Christopher Knowles. Chris, it's been a fascinating discussion, and I look forward to doing it again soon.
Oh, my pleasure.
And, of course, I'll put a link to Chris's work online at the Secret Sun blog in the show notes at PIDradio.com. Coming up Friday and Saturday, April 23rd and 24th, it's the Last Days Conference just outside Nashville, Tennessee. That's in Antioch, Tennessee. And I've been honored to serve as the moderator for the panel, which is just absolutely excellent. Dr. Lynn Marzulli, Guy Malone from AlienResistance.org, Dr. Michael Bennett, a.k.a. Dr. Future, and Mike Tater Jr., a.k.a. Tom Bionic, both of the Future Quake radio show. Russ Dizdar of Shattered the Darkness Ministries, documentary filmmaker Chris Pinto, George Jordan. Just a fascinating two-day discussion of the signs of the times and what is ahead. And you'll find a link to that in the header at the website, pidradio.com. I'm Derek Gilbert. Until next time, thanks for listening. This is A View from the Bunker.